it was expected to be a coronation, then it shockingly became a contest, but eventually it ended in a cakewalk. World number one, Scotty Scheffler, won his third major title and his first PGA Championship by 5 shots. But it wasn't entirely as easy as the final leaderboard at Quail Hollow would suggest. A post-mortem on the 107th PGA Championship is coming up on Golf Today.
Golf Today.
What a Sunday it was at Quail Hollow as Scotty Scheffler wins the PGA Championship and he gets to take home some pretty big hardware. Now a 3-time major champion and a 15-time winner on the PGA Tour. As we say hello and welcome, Matt Adams alongside of Eamon Lynch. And Eamon, we're not even 24 hours after yet another major championship has the name of Scotty Scheffler attached to it forevermore. What's your reaction to all that we saw?
We are on a pretty intriguing run of major championships of late, and yesterday for a while it looked as though there was going to be an entirely unexpected loss before Scotty Scheffler kind of realised who he is, which is basically Seabiscuit, and turned on the afterburners, and off he went and did what you'd expect. But it was a remarkable reset because we see so many guys get the wobbles on a Sunday afternoon under major championship pressure. It's very rare to see a guy survive the wobbles, reset the wobbles. But we've now seen it 2 majors in a row because we certainly saw that out of Rory McIlroy at Augusta National. And we saw it yesterday out of Scotty Scheffler at Quail Hollow. And, you know, he has a trait, Matt, that I don't think we've seen very much of since the Tiger Woods era. There's an inevitability about Scotty Scheffler. Once he puts himself in position, it just seems like the march towards the trophy has begun and nobody else is going to get in his way. It did very briefly look as though he was going to be derailed yesterday, but the only other time I've seen that since the Tiger era was a 2-3 year period when Koepka would put himself in the mix in a major championship and there was just that air of inevitability that he wasn't going to go anywhere. That's what Scotty Scheffler has now, and I think that's an intimidation value that doesn't happen very often in this game.
It's interesting that you phrase it that way because I often wonder if we ask modern players, his peers today, are they intimidated by Scotty Scheffler? If we had asked that question just a few short years ago, everyone would have said no more so than anybody else. But if you ask that question during the run of Tiger Woods to a man, almost every one of them would say yeah. Because I remember it was Brad Faxon one time telling me the problem with Tiger is when you see him rising up on the leaderboard, you know that whatever he needs to do, he will do it, which is an incredible way to attest to his power. This major was an interesting one because along the lines of what you were just saying, it looked as though Scotty Scheffler was becoming consumed by the moment. It looked as though nerves were actually impacting him, overtaking him. And then we find out in his press conference later on that he actually corrected his swing as he was going, get a little more squared up in his shoulders instead of closed on his left side that may have been contributing to that left miss. I also think luck had an element to play in what he did because by my count, he missed at least 6 to 8 shots on that opening 9, and he got away with a lot, the ability to get a club on it and hit a second shot or otherwise from there. So for all these different reasons, it was fascinating the way it went that in what? A 70-minute period, we went from Scotty and John Rahm battling at the top of the leaderboard to Scotty leading by multiple strokes.
And it's interesting to see you look at it from almost from a different angle that I did, because I looked at Scotty thinking he looked entirely impervious to what was going on. He looked befuddled by his own inability to do what he does every other week of the year. I wasn't necessarily sure that it looked so much as though it was just pressure as opposed to his own swing was short-circuiting and he couldn't quite understand why it was, and once he figured out with Ted Scott what it was, well then he just sort of
But that's proceeded. Amazing. You remember what Trevino said, a hook doesn't listen.
Yeah, well apparently a hook does listen to Ted Scott and Scotty Scheffler. Well, he's now getting into some rarefied company here. Let's take a look at the youngest players with 3 majors and at least 15 PGA Tour victories. So when you're on a graphic, Jack Nicklaus and Tiger Woods, you're probably on a Hall of Fame trajectory pretty early in your career. And afterwards, Scotty Scheffler met with the media.
I felt like this was as hard as I've battled for a tournament in my career. I mean, this was a pretty challenging week. I mean, the first 2 days I did not swing at my best and I was able to post the score somehow. And, you know, outside of the last 5 holes yesterday, you know, that's where I really kind of put myself ahead in the tournament. And, I mean, the back nine today was pretty special as well. But yesterday, the way I finished off that round, I think it was really important for me to have a lead to play with today. And, you know, I played with it a little bit more than I would have liked to. I think at one point in the tournament, I was tied for the lead on the back nine, but stepped up when we needed to. And it was a pretty special week.
Scotty, given what you went through last year in Louisville, is this even sweeter?
I mean, it's definitely very sweet sitting here with the trophy. I definitely have a few jokes that I want to say that I'm probably going to keep to myself.
Go for it.
Yeah, that's not a good idea. That's a good question. I think, I don't know. You know, last year sometimes it still doesn't almost feel real. I mean, it really doesn't. And it's just one of those deals that I really don't know how to describe it, but I can tell you it's very sweet sitting here with the trophy this year. You know, this was a hard week, a very difficult golf course, and very difficult conditions over the weekend. I mean, the winds were high, and it was very challenging. And, you know, I'm definitely I'm very pleased to be sitting here with the trophy. It's a pretty sweet feeling.
Well, life is pretty sweet for Scottie Scheffler right now, but we live in an era when non-stories become the subject of conversations. And this week, the PGA Championship was no different. Drivers were front and center at Quail Hollow, and early in the week, Rory McIlroy's was deemed non-conforming by the USGA, which happens pretty much every week on the PGA Tour. But his wasn't the only driver that failed the test, as we learned Sunday night.
A big topic of conversation this week has been the driver testing. Was your driver one of the ones tested this week?
Yeah.
And did you have to make any change?
Yeah.
And how did that go? Did that have anything to do with hitting it left today?
No, I think that was my fault. So the driver testing is something that regularly happens on tour. You know, my driver did fail at the beginning of this week. We had a feeling that it was going to be coming because I had used that driver for over a year. And so I was kind of fortunate for it to last that long, I felt like. And I would argue that if we're going to test the drivers, we need to be even more robust in the way we test them. And that was a conversation I had with one of the rules officials is I think if it's something that we're going to take seriously, I feel like we're almost going kind of halfway with it right now, where if we're going to test only a third of the field, I mean, if we're going to do it right, you know, leave it up to us as players like the rest of the rules in the game of golf are. This is just, it's a newer rule that we haven't quite gotten right yet. And I think we have some stuff to figure out. And I think if we're going to do it, we might as well do it right and get even more robust, even more strict. And I mean, you can test guys every week if you want. I mean, there's no reason why we shouldn't.
Matt, you cover the equipment part of this industry extensively. From a technical standpoint, this is a non-story. From an administrative standpoint, in terms of how this testing is done and to the extent to which it's made public, that seems to be the bigger issue here.
I think that's what Scotty was talking about when he said we haven't quite got this rule right. I don't think he was talking about the technical side. And the technical side, just for clarity here, is 0.82, which means the inbound energy coming into the strike of the golf ball can't be beyond 0.82 in the outbound energy going into the golf ball itself. So what happens with these drivers today is because they have variable face thickness, which basically means that the thinnest part of the face is right in the dead center, and you've got the best players in the world who are going to hit it in the dead center more than anybody else on the planet. It's not a question of if that will eventually give. It's a question of when that gives. What I think Scotty was referring to there was 30 clubs being tested in a field. If you're going to take the time to be there, if you're going to do these testing, why not test the entire field? Then the other half of it goes to this idea of keeping the results secret, which I think kind of leaves the players out there twisting, because it leaves all these questions of, did a player know? When could they have known? I could tell you, technically, there's no way that a player could know if their club is or is not conforming. In fact, sometimes when they actually get cracks in those skinny faces, and it usually happens inside of the groove, so you get negative performance. So it actually helps you to know that something's going on with your driver, because these measurements are so precise and so tiny. So, yes, I think if they're going to go in and they're going to do the testing every week, test everybody in the field and then make it public.
But it also creates a scenario where the clickbait grifters on social media can sort of manufacture a story. And I just don't fail to understand why kryptonite is transparency in this game. It doesn't matter if it's slow play or driver testing or drug testing or anything else. The instinct is always to obfuscate here. And it never seems to be to put the information out there, and particularly in an era where professional golf at all levels is encouraging a relationship with legalized sports gambling, information is key. And covering up information creates a very negative perception out there. And golf needs to start organizing itself like a major sport and not like a nanny state, which is kind of the world we're living in.
That's why this is a microcosm of much more. So that golf's governing bodies needn't be reactive. Get in on the front side of this. And you've got players just like now, you got the number one player in the world, Scottie Scheffler, saying that we haven't quite got this right and we're seeing the results of it. And then we find out that Scottie was one of those drivers that didn't pass a test as well, which kind of quelled people on that. When it comes to Rory and people online saying that, you know, it would tarnish his Masters win, et cetera, that's ridiculous because there's no way that he could have known what was going on with that face.
Well, online is a bottomless pit of stupidity, as we've found out over the years. A man not short of opinions is going to join us now. Gary Williams, he's the host of Five Clubs on Golf Channel. And, of course, Gary, you were in Charlotte. You live in Charlotte, but you were at the golf course all week as well for Sirius XM Radio. On the subject of Scottie Scheffler, are we getting a little ahead of ourselves here when we start putting him on graphics with Jack and Tiger, then we're starting to measure him in a very historical sense very early in his career? Should he still be measured against his current generation of peers?
Yeah, I think you can do both. And it's a fun exercise. You guys both know we have the epidemic of recency bias and being caught up in the moment is what happens to a lot of people, particularly people who cover sports. But when we put up graphics that associate him and put him in the company of people that are iconic figures in the sport, I think it's natural to say, and again, this is where you can have a fun, interesting, and maybe instructive conversation as it pertains to whether it be Jack or whether it be Tiger, as to why he may or why he may not. And so if you just look at the players who did not even get to double digits, the last man to get to 9 major championships was Gary Player, and he did that in 1978. The last man to get to 8 was Tom Watson. He did that in 1983. And the last one to get to 7 was Arnold Palmer with his 1964 Masters victory. So it's like, well, what can that teach us? Well, see, think about how long ago all of those things are and how much has changed, how global the game is. I firmly believe, I'd like to believe you guys do too, that more people are capable to win golf tournaments and these golf tournaments now more than they could 42 years ago, 50 years ago, 60 years ago. And then you start to consider him. And I think that he is unusual in a lot of ways, starting with the fact that I've never seen somebody in this sport, and really any other sport right now of this generation, that refuses to genuflect on his own accomplishment and refuses to project ahead of what something might mean. He doesn't just say, I want to be where my feet are. He does it. He does it with his words. He does it with his actions. So those things together, I think it's fair and fun to have these conversations, but to contextualize it and say, let's remember how hard it is to get to 6, to get to 7. And then you can start to celebrate those guys who did get there while you're doing it.
Gary, I have to tell you, I was smiling as you were coming onto the program with us because here Eamon was talking about social media as a bottomless pit of stupidity. Let's bring in Gary Williams to comment on all things. It was absolutely classic. Now, I do want to ask you, because you're in Charlotte, as noted. You're there all week. Quail Hollow has hosted big events before this, huge events, a major championship, President's Cup, PGA Tour events, etc. In the wake of this PGA Championship, what are you hearing at home? How do you think the perception of the club has changed?
You know, I don't think the perception of the club locally has changed. I think like anywhere you live, if you like where you live, I think reflexively you're proud, and then you would be defensive if people started saying things that were even mildly disparaging. I don't have any doubt that Quail Hollow is a great venue for professional golf. But I think that the more interesting and more relevant and instructive question to have is these 4 events that we have in the men's game, are so precious, one, to win, and two, to host. And so with the exception, maybe if you want to put Pebble in that category of the lone exception, being in a category where it is an anchor site for the USGA, for the US Open, other than that, let's not do this. I don't think that's unreasonable, but I think, look, this is a great town for golf. That's the reason why the PGA Tour has been good here. And that's the reason why Truist, they're the only Signature Series event that is a new sponsor that did a seven-year, $200 million deal. They didn't do that accidentally. They also didn't do it because they happen to be headquartered here. They did it because they know this market is good for men's professional golf. And then if you want to talk about design principles and the holes and all that stuff, that's worthwhile as well. I think it's a little quail fatigue is part of it. And then the other part of it is, come on, let's see some other places. And I get all of it. But as far as the way people feel about Quail, I don't think anything said about whether we have good restaurants, whether this is a city that has soul or doesn't, or whether Quail Hollow is a good venue or not, influence anybody's thoughts about Quail Hollow who actually lives here.
One of the things that would influence people's reaction, I guess, to Quail Hollow was the drama that it served up, in the same way that Valhalla, an otherwise unspectacular venue, has actually served up its share of drama over the years. Gary, when you look at John Rahm and Bryson DeChambeau in particular, both put themselves into the mix, both now playing on LIV, is there an argument that the way in which they finished suggests that LIV doesn't encourage the kind of competitive sharpness that other guys have, when you consider that they've played less competitive rounds this year? In fact, they've played three of their competitive rounds at night under floodlights in Riyadh in the first tournament of their season. Is that a detriment to those guys?
Eamon, I think the overall schedule on LIV does not do any favors to the elite players that have exemptions in all the majors, just in general. I don't think hopscotching all over the world, I don't think playing grasses that are not agronomically kind of in line with wherever the next major championship venue is or isn't, is good for their run-ups to these four events. I think there are a lot of things. I'm not saying it may not be a factor, but I'm not saying that it is the reason why those two guys on the gauntlet, that is the last three holes of that golf course, did what they did. The guy who didn't is the guy who is the most unwavering guy when the heat gets the hottest, and that is Scottie Scheffler. John hadn't been there in a little while. And I also think, guys, and you tell me how you feel about this, he knows the guy behind him is less inclined to make a mistake. So does he not feel the pressure to take things on maybe that are not the most prudent thing to do down the stretch, like on the 17th hole? And I think that's one of the great weapons that Scottie Scheffler has. Look at the three majors that he's won. Because you are not inclined to believe he's going to make a mistake, you then feel the pressure. And look, it's not fun anyway if you feel kind of comfortable to take on big shots that are paramount down the stretch of majors. But those three holes, I don't know. I think we are peeling back a lot of layers to then get to LIV as to why the last three holes got to those two guys. I think there are other factors that are probably more tangibly related than those, but I'm not going to eliminate it altogether.
Hey, Gary, I want to ask you about a couple of Irish goodbyes in the week that was. First, we saw Shane Lowry after his ball looked like it was plugged in the fairway, and then apparently attested by a reporter on the grounds that hole that he was in actually wasn't his, so he wasn't granted relief from it. Bizarre nonetheless. But to Rory McIlroy, Rory McIlroy is sometimes criticized for what he has said over the course of his career, and this week he's being criticized, well, for what he didn't say.
Yeah, let me start with Shane. That situation, God, the oddity of all of that, that the person, like you said, who's affiliated with ESPN, who kind of found himself in a situation where he was there to confirm that it wasn't Shane's own pitch mark, and then he subsequently had to play the ball out of that somewhat embedded ball and then created a nice, you know, bath mat in anger, peeling that layer of sod out of the ground. Look, he has moments where he redlines. And, you know, look, I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, gosh, we should never see that. I have no idea what the intensity is like to be in that cauldron. And he's going to do that every blue moon. It happens. With respect to Rory, and this to me is the more important thing, one thing I don't know is what's going on with someone else, anybody else. I do not know that if what transpired on Friday afternoon before he finished his second round, which was the news that his driver failed on Tuesday and was deemed non-conforming, and by the time he got in, before he walked over that bridge to come into what would have been the scrum area, he begged off, and it wasn't like he shot 65, but he is the Masters champion, just won a Grand Slam title, and he begged off on Thursday when he shot 74. I kind of understand if he was running hot, you know what, best to leave it alone. I'll talk tomorrow. Again, I don't know what's going on with him, but to not speak for 4 days is unfortunate. It's unfortunate for the PGA of America, of which he's a two-time champion. I think it's unfortunate for the sport of men's professional golf that is a television entertainment product. And the guy who is the biggest story coming in provides no color, no quotes, no matter what he shot over the course of the entire championship. And let's say he wanted to give his view on the policy, as you guys were just discussing, about the way that testing is done and the information and how it is confidential. How constructive and instructive that could have been if a guy who had his driver fail gave his position, not just on what happened with him, but just on the policy at large to maybe drive change. That, to me, is part of why him not speaking at all is disappointing.
Gary, we want to thank you very much for your time, my friend. We could spend the whole show speaking to you. You guys can hear Gary speak Monday through Friday right here on Golf Channel at 8 a.m. Eastern for 5 clubs. We'll talk to you again. Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
Well, the second major of the season has been put to rest, mostly.
But the weekly circus is moving on to another town.
PGA Tour is in Fort Worth for the Charles Schwab Challenge this week. The man affectionately known as the Big Rig is in the field, Harry Higgs, coming off a playoff loss in his last start. And Harry is with us next.
Golf Central Update, brought to you by Callaway Golf.
Scottie Scheffler continues to dominate the men's professional game. His 5-shot win on Sunday is the largest in a PGA Championship since Rory McIlroy won by 8 in 2012. Scheffler is now a 3-time major champion. Now life rolls along for the world number one. He's scheduled to tee it up again this week as the PGA Tour heads to historic Colonial Country Club in Fort Worth, Texas for the Charles Schwab Challenge. Coverage begins Thursday right here on Golf Channel.
Well, Harry Higgs is teeing it up at Colonial this week. His last win came on the Corn Ferry Tour back in May. He came out on top at the Visit Knoxville Open with this 37-foot eagle putt to break Frankie Sappan in a playoff. That was Harry's third title on the Corn Ferry Tour, always one of the more popular figures out there. And Harry Higgs joins us now. Harry, thanks for spending some time with us. We spent a lot of time talking about Scottie Scheffler, what we saw yesterday. You play and compete against Scottie Scheffler. What do you as a player see when you watch that performance? What most impresses you about watching the best in the business?
Oof. I think it was Michael Kim on Twitter, maybe his little tweets, which I love following, I think Saturday evening, maybe, that Scottie's inevitable. And the thing that I think is most impressive is just how boring and routine Scottie makes it look, and it's far from it. Yeah, he's definitely, obviously, the best in the world, and he can go. He's the best in the world, and he seems like he's on a pretty good hot stretch, too, which makes him really hard to beat, and not many people have done it.
Harry, since we are reacting to everything PGA Championship, let's go back to 2021 at Kiawa, where you have that final round, bogey-free, such as it was, that vaulted you up into a tie for fourth. Can you give us a glimpse into the hearts and minds of a competitor at a major championship and what that swirling fray has to feel like?
Yeah, well, if you speak that round, bogey-free, yes. I think I might have hit like 6 or 7 greens and obviously legitimately got everything up and down. So we just talked about Scotty and how he does it. That day, I did it pretty much the exact opposite. I was kind of all over the place and literally got everything up and down to hold a bunch of par putts. Yeah, I mean, the coolest part for me was my brother was on the bag, and I remember we were in the 16th fairway, and I believe maybe I was three shots back at the time, and the leaders were a handful of holes behind me. Par five, waiting for the green to clear, and, you know, basically had to make a decision on 16. We were going for it, but which club to hit, you know. I needed to make the decision to hit whatever club gave me the best chance to make an eagle, because if I, you know, make an eagle on the hole, I have a chance to win a major. For me, that was just like complete and utter excitement. It just, I don't know. I have worked and will continue to work to have that opportunity again. They obviously don't present themselves that much. Really, you know, for me, might just be once. I certainly hope it's multiple, but yeah, it was just like joy and excitement. It was so fun to be in the mix, you know, much like it was even, what, almost 2 weeks ago now. You know, it's just so fun to be in the mix. You just don't get to do it very often. And, you know, I'm working. I'm starting to believe more and more that I'm capable of it more and more and more, working harder than I've ever worked to get those tastes. But golf's a weird game, and it doesn't always happen.
Now, you mentioned the Myrtle Beach event on the PGA Tour a couple of weeks ago. You lost a playoff there, Harry. You hadn't been playing particularly well until you got there. Did you find something in your game that week that's going to propel you forward?
Other than, like, walking around thinking that I'm better than everybody, no. And yeah, everybody, we all do that. It's, you know, it's just kind of, you know, tap into kind of your inner competitive psycho, if you will, that, like, I'm just going to beat everybody. I'm going to find a way, no matter what, I'm going to beat everybody. I know the results have not shown it up until really, what, a week and a half ago now it is. But I really felt like I was playing better than I was scoring, better than any of the stats would show. I was trying not to just beat my head against the wall too much, because it felt like at some point, you know, you're going to hold a handful of putts and you're going to get in the mix. And then, you know, I think I'm my most skilled golfer that I've ever been, you know, professionally. Now, saying that, I don't think I had hardly a top 30 finish all year until a couple weeks ago. But yeah, no, not much changed other than maybe just not even really my belief, but just, hey, you know what? I am good enough to do this. Let's just go out there and do it. And hopefully I'm going to try to tap into that again for the rest of the year. And hopefully, you know, basically I don't get knocked off my perch, and I'm usually the one that knocks me off, by getting frustrated at little things that I can't control, or, you know, things that happen. Golf is a stupid game. It's the best, but it's stupid too.
Harry, I have to tell you, you're channeling a very different vibe today with the very academic looking glasses and the hoodie that's right on the collarbone instead of the wide open shirt that looks 1978. Go ahead.
Yeah, this week is a home event. So I did my work at home. I didn't even go out to Colonial. I was in the middle of making, kind of early preps for dinner. We're going to do some smash burger tacos and homemade sweet potato fries, and we'll figure out some kind of vegetable. These home weeks are odd. You know, I don't have many chores. God love my wife. She pretty much does everything here at home. But this week I'm going to, you know, I'm going to go be my competitive psycho self at Colonial, and then I'm going to get back here and I'm going to have to do chores and clean up and empty the dishwasher. And those things are just different. When it's a hotel or an Airbnb, you might put those off, but I can't really put them off here. I'm looking forward to the week, though. It's a fun week. Colonial's awesome. And I hadn't been there since I didn't play last year. I hadn't been there since they changed a few things. So I'm really excited to go see it tomorrow.
It's also important, I guess, to enjoy those weeks where you do actually have a sense of community around you, Harry. This is a kind of a tough week for the tour. It was a year ago where Grayson Murray withdrew from Colonial and later took his own life. And you initiated a really important mental health conversation in the aftermath of that. And you talked about the need to be kinder to yourself, given all of the frustrations, living in a world where your self-worth can be determined by whatever number you write on a scorecard at the end of the day. Are you still actually managing to do that? Are you still being kind to yourself despite all of the frustrations?
Yeah. Look, like anything, I could certainly do a whole lot better at it. I think one of the things, and you asked me, what was different between basically last year and this year so far. I think last year I was much more kind to myself, not as quick to anger and get, uber frustrated with just obviously some things that we just can't control. It will be a difficult week, the reminder of Grayson. But, in that selfishly for me, it'll probably be a good thing to be reminded to be kinder and, care for your loved ones. I've got both my in-laws and my mom and dad will be here. My brother lives here. This will be a big family week. So, go enjoy doing something that I've always wanted to do and worked my entire life to do is play professional golf on the PGA Tour. Go and enjoy that with the people that I care and love for the most. It'll be a difficult week. I'm looking forward to seeing. I'm sure the folks over there at Colonial will have some pretty cool ideas and remembrances, ways to remember Grayson, kind of the impact he made. And certainly, hopefully I'm holding the trophy at the end of the week and reminding myself and others again that, be kind to one another, be kind to people you do not know, and be kind, probably more importantly, to yourself. As most conversations, I wind up using them as therapy for myself. It's going to be a good reminder. I'm going to write that in my yardage book.
Well, be kind. If you are with that trophy on Sunday night, I can't imagine it being a more popular winner on the PGA Tour. And regardless of what the number is in the scorecard, at least there's something fun for you waiting at home, including the smash burgers and the sweet potato fries. Harry, it's always great to catch up with you.
You got it, guys. Really enjoyed it. Take care.
Thank you so much. That's awesome. It's easy to see why so many are fans of that man. All right, more reaction than 107th PGA Championship coming up. And back on Golf Today, what a duo these two are. Scottie Scheffler and Ted Scott picking up their first major together at the 2022 Masters. Ted Scott added another Masters flag to his collection in 2024. Scheffler slipped on the green jacket for a second time. Then on Sunday, a new flag added to the collection as Scheffler won the 107th PGA Championship with, of course, Ted Scott by his side. With more on the week, we are delighted to welcome in Golf Channel senior writer Rex Hoggard and Paige McKenzie. Both were on site last week for us at Quail Hollow. Welcome to you both. So, Paige, I'm going to jump in with you first and throw a blanket question at you. Here we are now the day after. What's your reaction to everything that took place over the last week?
First of all, it was interesting to watch Quail Hollow host the major championship. We felt like we knew the golf course. We felt like we knew who was going to rise to the top of the leaderboard. And the first couple of days, I think it was shocking as different names were on the leaderboard, and certainly names that we were expecting to play well, like Rory McIlroy and Xander Schauffele, were not. But then ultimately, I think what we all saw on Sunday was a determined perseverance, Scottie Scheffler ultimately come out. And I think that's going to be one of my biggest takeaways, that Scottie Scheffler was able to battle himself both physically and mentally to get over the finish line.
Rex, there's nothing golf loves more than very esoteric and wholly subjective debates, usually around golf courses. And Quail Hollow seemed to be subject to that early in the week as to whether or not it was sort of different enough or had enough character or enough history or stature to be a major championship venue. It turned out to be very much a stern test of execution for these guys. Do you think it's deserving of another major championship down the road, that it kind of held its own despite the early criticism?
I feel like Quail Hollow is a really good PGA Tour course. And I don't mean that as a backhanded comment or to be disrespectful to the course or the membership. We all know what Johnny Harris has done, just not at that course, but in the community of Charlotte. And it's a really special place, and it's a really cool golf course. And it did turn out to be a stern test. When you look at what John Rahm had to overcome coming down the stretch, and he couldn't, I think that's a testament to how good the golf course was. I'm just saying, when it comes to a major championship venue, it didn't have enough separation from what we see year in and year out at the Truist Championship. It felt like we were there at the Truist Championship. A signature event, a great field, but it didn't feel special. I just go back to the week before when we all sort of sat and marveled at Philly Cricket Club and how cool that was. It didn't have that vibe, and there was nothing the PGA of America did to set it up in a different or special way.
Rex, I'm going to stay with you just for a second if I can here, because in the wake of the first men's major of 2025, the story was pretty much completely about Rory McIlroy and what he accomplished at Augusta National. In the wake of this PGA Championship, there are a number of different storylines that are being discussed. Obviously, the glory that was Scottie Scheffler, rightfully so, but there's other ones as well. Rory not addressing the media and what's the reaction to that. The whole driver gate and the reaction to that and more, including Jon Rahm and how he played and what his reaction was to it, including a thrown driver by Wyndham Clark, et cetera. What is it about this major championship that there's so many storylines backing up the primary one?
And we didn't even mention mud bombs. Yeah. So we didn't even get into that. I mean, when you consider how far we've actually gone with this, it is fascinating that we spent a lot of time this week not really talking about the golf. And certainly the driver gate, whatever that was with Scottie and Rory McIlroy, was a bit of a distraction. I think it's a testament to how good the championship was that Scottie Scheffler, it's just his world, we're just living in it, was able to drag us all away from those distractions and create something that was compelling on the course, and also give Jon Rahm credit. I mean, he pushed him until he sort of ran into a buzzsaw late in the round, but I think that's a testament to the players on the course that we forgot about those distractions, at least for one Sunday afternoon.
Paige, you and I spent quite a bit of time in Charlotte with Aaron Oberholzer on Live From, kind of kicking around the names that we expected to be in the mix, and some of them surprisingly weren't, like Rory McIlroy, Justin Thomas. A couple of them were, in terms of Jon Rahm, Bryson DeChambeau. When you look at all the people who at some stage put themselves into the conversation yesterday afternoon, what most surprised you, or who do you think perhaps leaves most disappointed with not having the trophy because they didn't quite get it over the finish line?
Well, I think for sure the most disappointed is Jon Rahm and how he completed the golf tournament, given his play up until that point. And again, going back to Rex's point about this golf course, and I know I actually heard earlier the criticism with Jon Rahm maybe not being prepared due to his live schedule, but I do want to point out that the entirety of the back nine became a buzzsaw for a lot of the players. JT Poston bogeyed his last two holes. Matthew Fitzpatrick bogeyed his last three holes. Alex Noren was 4 over on his last nine. Tony Finau was 3 over on his last two. So Jon Rahm wasn't the only victim to the difficulty of this golf course coming down the stretch. But I do believe he would likely be the most disappointed of the names that I just listed, because he was the closest pursuer of Scottie Scheffler. And of course, we know what he's capable of, and the fact that of that list, he's the guy outside of Matt Fitzpatrick that has held a major championship trophy as well.
So, Paige, let's stay with Scottie just for a second. And given the fact that you're the only tour player amongst our ranks, how difficult is it to recognize and correct your own golf swing when you're in the middle of it?
Well, first of all, the only comparison that we have is that we both held a tour card at one time. Scottie Scheffler is in a league of his own, and I'm okay with admitting that. Incredibly difficult in the required time to be able to have the patience and discipline required to make those adjustments and not to panic and start to spiral. That's what he did well. But I want to point out, too, that this wasn't the first time that I've seen this from Scottie Scheffler. It's the first time in a major championship that I've seen it. But when I was working the WM Phoenix Open a couple of years ago, the exact same thing happened, where he had this left miss going. He only hit 5 fairways his final round, ultimately went on to win the golf tournament on a golf course that had easier fairways to hit and were more penalizing if you missed, statistically anyway. So Scottie Scheffler has had that happen before, and Brandel Chamblee pointed out on X earlier in the week, I think it was on Saturday night, that this is a player that has best eliminated the right side of the golf course, basically eliminated the right miss. So he already knows that if he misses, it's gonna be left, and he knows likely what causes those kind of misses. So I think, to his credit, he has at least narrowed when he gets off how he needs to fix it. But of course, that being said, you still have to execute, and there's no higher threshold than at a major championship to be able to do that.
Paige and Rex, thank you very much for joining us today. Excellent to get your insights on the week that was.
Thanks.
Well, nothing produces petulant outbursts quite like bad golf on a major championship Sunday. That's very nice. That's Wyndham Clark on his way to a tie for 50th. This is a poor shot
off the 16th tee. Not the worst shot we saw all day, but he had a better release on the club throw than he had on the actual swing itself. And the marshal standing behind that sign, which was badly damaged, as was the club, later posted this picture. I'm the marshal holding the flag. Scared me to death. So not doing any favours for the club, the sign, or his reputation.
This from Wyndham Clark today at his behaviour during the final round of the PGA Championship. Quoting, I would like to sincerely apologise for my behaviour yesterday on hole 16. As professionals, we are expected to remain professional even when frustrated, and I unfortunately let my emotions get the best of me. My actions were uncalled for and completely inappropriate, making it clear that I have things to work on. I hold myself to a high standard, trying to always play for something bigger than myself, and yesterday I fell short of those standards. For that, I am truly sorry. I promise to better the way I handle my frustrations on the course going forward, and hope you all can forgive me in due time. Close quote. What a Sunday it was at Quail Hollow as Scottie Scheffler wins the PGA Championship and gets to take home some pretty big hardware. Now a three-time major champion and a 15-time winner on the PGA Tour.
Golf Today.
A reminder, we're leading you into live coverage of the NCAA Division I Women's Golf Championship. That's underway at the Omni La Costa Resort and Spa in Carlsbad, California. Final round of stroke play today, and that determines the individual champion. That's coming up at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Welcome back in Golf Today. Amy Lynch alongside Matt Adams. We are still analysing everything that went down yesterday in Charlotte, North Carolina, with the, you know, Scottie Scheffler getting Grand Slam leg number two, major championship number three.
Yeah, very impressive indeed. 15 times a winner in the PGA Tour, as you just mentioned at the start of this hour. It has been very, very impressive with everything that we saw, including what we saw in action yesterday. Here he is at the 10th for birdie.
This is when he reset his golf swing on the tee with his caddy. Did a pretty successful job of it.
Beautiful drive at 10, beautiful drive at 11. At 15, he had an opportunity for eagle.
Taking the smart strategy here, putting from the fringe. Cozies that up pretty close. That got him his birdie, got him to 12 under par. At that point, it started to look very much like a done deal, and that's what it was. Here he is on the 18th hole. We'd all like a putt like that for a major championship. Word number one, getting his victory with Ted Scott at his side. He caught up with Todd Lewis afterwards.
Scotty, congratulations on one heck of a fight out there here at Quail Hollow today. You were hitting it left on your opening nine, as you openly admitted. I want to know, were you aware that you were tied at some point at John Rahm, and how much did that inspire you to turn things around on the closing nine?
Well, yeah, I mean, I knew somebody was going to make a move. You know, there was too many good names on the leaderboard and too much talent, you know, in the game of golf right now for somebody behind me to not make a move. And I wasn't surprised to see somebody up there the way I played the front nine. But, you know, I just did a good job of staying patient and trying to refocus. And, you know, hit a good tee ball on 10, made a really nice birdie putt there on 10 that kind of gave me some momentum going into the rest of the back nine. And two really huge birdies, I think, on 14 and 15 to kind of solidify things for myself and, you know, make it a little bit easier down the stretch, but, you know, with those three closing holes, you can't relax too much. So made two good pars on 16 and 17 and got to relax on 18.
Was that more of a mental or a mechanical shift on that closing nine for you?
I'd say a bit of both. You know, getting over the, you know, kind of when we were walking off the tee on nine, I looked at Teddy. I was like, man, that one kind of felt pretty good. And I looked up and it was still left. So I didn't know exactly what to do, and Teddy said, maybe just aim it over there, so try and aim a little further right. And so over the next one, I felt like I squared my shoulders a little bit, and you know, that was it, and you know, I hit it really good after that.
And you know your rise is meteoric when you're being compared to these superstars. The shortest span between the first and 15th PGA Tour victories, he's third on that list, 3 years, 94 days. The only guys ahead of him, Jack Nicklaus, Tiger Woods. Time now for Golf Today Roundtable as we welcome in GolfDigest.com contributor Shane Ryan and Brendan Porath, who is the co-host of the Shotgun Start podcast and two guys who are now growing old enough to be called eminence greases in golf media. Brendan, I'm going to start with you, mainly because I know you have a lot of kids' homework to review before you go to bed tonight. There's an argument over the golf course at every major venue, but particularly last week, this idea that the golf course needs to have more character, more history, more stature. Is it not enough to just simply be a stern test, which is where Quail Hollow proved itself to be? Where do you come down on that argument?
I think it is enough, but I think also we only have four of these a year. So the standard, I think, should be exceptionally high. I think it was a fine golf course, a fine test. There was a distinction. It was much, it separated good from great shot in a much better way than last year at Valhalla. I think there was also a familiarity issue, right? We see a significant PGA Tour event there every single year, almost to the precise week. So I think that added to some of the fatigue and the blowback and these sort of pot shots about its character or soul. I thought it is a proper test that you know, the line you heard repeatedly was you can't fake it. And that is true. It might not require the most thought of the major championship courses, but it was a fine test. You had to actually make the shots, and the separation between great and average was divined out.
Shane, why don't you jump in on this? How much, when it comes to the setup for a major championship, is a golf club simply a victim of the way the governing body wants it to be arranged?
Well, yeah, I mean, you could blame the setup, but I think, you know, the bones are there, right? There's not that much you can do with it. And I am by no means an architecture expert. I'm almost the worst person you could have asked that question to. But, you know, Quail Hollow, like, I've been there a lot. It's basic. Like Brendan said, it does test you. It values the drive, the off the tee game and the long iron game at a significantly higher rate than even your average difficult tour course. So there is a lot of skill, but I think people sometimes want to see a lot of excitement. And it's funny because, you know, I talked with a few members of the club there on different topics, and they were all a little bit hurt at all the criticism coming their way, because it is a beautiful property and it's a wonderful club. But again, as Brendan said, four times a year this happens, so the standard is pretty high.
On the subject, Shane, of testing, specifically driver testing, seemed to make some of the news last week as well with the revelations that Rory McIlroy's and later Scottie Scheffler's driver both failed USGA testing early in the week and had to be adjusted. How much of an onus is there on the actual entity running the tournament, whether it's PGA of America last week or PGA Tour most weeks, to make that kind of information public? Because it's a non-story in the sense that it does happen almost every week when these driver faces do kind of break down. But should that information become public to make sure that it's a non-story?
Yeah, and you make a great point, because there's this strange irony or contradiction in the fact that, well, we keep it confidential to protect the player, except what we see is that in cases where the player is high profile, like Rory or, you know, Xander Schauffele in 2019 at the Open, the information leaks. And so then you have the case where everybody knows it and it's being published and all of that, but the governing body still sticks to this thing for at least, you know, until Saturday in the PGA of America's case where, oh, we don't talk about it. And so you combine that with the fact that Rory wasn't talking either, and speculation runs wild about what this is and what it means. And really, I think that lasted at least one or two days with that narrative going out of control before sort of sensible voices prevailed and said, actually, this is not a big deal. It happens all the time. It happened to Scottie Scheffler, too. So, look, I think it was a mistake for them to wait that long. I think it was a little unfair to Rory to kind of hang him out to dry on that. And also, I thought it was a bad move by Rory not to speak right away and say, here's the deal. Like, this doesn't mean, you know, I cheated at the Masters or anything. You know, he needed to do that. But the problem was, you saw on social media, people are calling him a cheater, saying the win at Augusta is tainted. And I think that at least could have been curbed for a lot of the, you know, medium faith actors, if not the bad faith ones, if more information was out there to begin with.
So, Brendan, let's stay with Rory here for a second then, since Shane and Eamon are taking us down this road. It's easy to say that we have finished the week with more questions about Rory than we have answers. My question is, why were there so many questions to it? What's your take on Rory McIlroy looking back on this PGA Championship?
I thought it was a strange week. I thought it should have been a victory lap, both on the course and off the course. Obviously, we know his history there as a competitor. It was odd or unexpected, I would say, to not see him with the two other big favorites going into it. Who showed up and competed? One, and Bryson finished. I think he finished T2. And you know, I think those expectations were there for Rory based on his history there. It was strange that he didn't play better. What was increasingly odd, though, was he almost seemed grumpy, almost in a sour mood, and it could have been from the driver testing. I didn't fully understand blowing off the press all 4 days. I know he spoke before the round, before the championship, but maybe 1 day, 2 days. And I get he spoke plenty of times in front of the press, more than anyone really over the last 3 or 4 years on every subject. And so he makes himself available. I just thought, you know, the narrative of he's unburdened, this should be a celebratory week regardless of how he played. He could have missed the cut, and he should have been taking victory laps and celebrating. And I think the press, in a lot of instances, is almost there to celebrate him sometimes too much. But it was just odd, I guess. I don't have any searing critique. I thought it was just strange the way it developed for him, both on and off the course, coming off of kind of a career achievement that should be celebrated for the rest of the summer.
Shane, this conversation has existed for a while about obligations or responsibilities that players have with the media. It certainly came up in the wake of Bay Hill when Colin Morikawa said he didn't owe anyone anything. It kind of spilled over into the Masters as well with Colin. Should it be mandatory? Because that was the point Rory made at the time, was that it's not mandatory, therefore these guys can blow it off. Should it be part of the condition of entry to a tournament that they, if requested, and if they are part of a storyline, that they do actually appear?
Yeah, I think maybe, and not because of the concept of, you know, you owe us anything or anything like that, but just because it would make it so much easier and it would avoid these type of things. You know, during the Morikawa thing, I said over and over, I hate framing it as to what somebody owes anybody. What I like framing it as is, you know, who is it good for? Well, definitely it's good for the press that they talk to us. But I think, you know, to a reasonable extent, it's also really good for them. And I thought, again, you always see it spill over. Like, the people getting on Morikawa were not just the press. It was the public, too, saying, wow, he sounds entitled. And this week you saw the same thing. Oh, you know, the press didn't like that Rory didn't stop. But you also had people on social media or whatever going, you know, he's being a baby and all that kind of stuff. So I don't think it works for them. You know, you could look at the same thing with the confidentiality stuff. Make it public because it makes it easier for everybody. Have it be mandatory that they talk to the press because it makes it easier. It takes the choice out of it, and it takes some of this negative publicity potential away.
So John Rahm yesterday, Brendan, did speak to the press. After that finish, he sat down in front of everybody. It was a real relatable press conference. I would dare say it was one that gave us some good insights into John Rahm, even admitting that he was somewhat embarrassed with the way that he finished. But earlier in the week, he bristled at the suggestion that perhaps playing on LIV was not the stage upon which to get himself ready for a major championship. Now, in retrospect, when we look back on the week, what would you make of that thought?
Well, there was a little bit slipped in his press conference yesterday where he said that was the most fun I've had on a golf course in a really long time. I don't know if he made the wanted to make the direct implication there that the other golf he's been playing has not been particularly fun for him on LIV and as a team with his Legion group. But that is the implication of the statement. He'd not been in, you know, prime contention for a major in over a year. He had dabbled with it a little bit at Troon. I think, you know, he is an elite talent that kind of supersedes the weekly reps. We've seen this with Brooks Koepka. It doesn't necessarily matter, per se, where he's playing. Could he be improved? Would he be maybe happier playing week to week in signature events on the PGA Tour? Sure. That's probably a talking point you want to throw his way if you're an advocate for the PGA Tour. But I think he is one of those talents that could supersede the week-to-week reps in between the majors, and we're seeing him. He spoke that his swing, you know, if you paid attention, his swing was not necessarily where it was supposed to be before he left for LIV, after that Masters. It was kind of on a downward trajectory after that Masters win. So I don't think he's incredibly grievously harmed by playing on LIV, but he did seem happier, certainly, and he said so in his post-game press conference.
Well, one guy who's probably happy, although not maybe with his results, Shane, Dustin Johnson, some horrendous golf out of Dustin last week. He wasn't even actually Lo Johnson. Tom Johnson, a 43-year-old club pro out of Sacramento, clipped him by a couple of shots. Dustin's about to go back to Oakmont, where he won the US Open 9 years ago. Is there any reason whatsoever for any optimism on DJ at Oakmont?
I just love this statement. You're like, let's kick it to Shane to insult DJ for a little while. No, I guess not. No, I don't think there's any optimism. He hasn't played well. You know, we talk about the guys, you know, who go to LIV and you're like, well, yeah, you've had major champions from LIV. You had Brooks and Bryson, other guys where it's ambiguous. Maybe Rom has, you know, not benefited from that, or maybe it's something else with his swing. There are a few guys who do seem to have checked out a little bit. And look, I'm not a mind reader with DJ, but yeah, I would call DJ one of those guys that hasn't been playing good golf. So yeah, you got me, Eamon. don't pick DJ at Oakmont. Is that what you wanted?
Well, I think it's a valid question, because it's not as though he was one of the guys who was at the tail end of a career when he went to LIV. He was still only 36, 37 years old at the time. He wasn't like a Westwood or a Poulter whose best days were clearly in the rearview mirror, but he just seems like a guy who has entirely disconnected from the elite level of the game.
Yeah, and there are younger guys too. I mean, Cam Smith is somebody who it seems like he's disappeared. You know, there are a number of guys like that that don't seem to have benefited from it. And other guys like Bryson, who it seems like made the best possible decision for himself. So I really think it's on an individual basis, but there definitely is an element of some guys checking out for sure.
Brandon, I will not try to set you up to probe into the mind of Dustin Johnson, but I do want to ask you this question, to probe into the mind of Bryson. He ended up finishing tied for second. He said yesterday, Sunday afterwards, that he was baffled by what took place. And he seemed to imply that whether it was equipment or golf ball or technique, that there are some things that he's working on as we head to Oakmont. Your thoughts for Bryson?
Oh, not just working on. He used the term tricks up his sleeve. So who knows? Maybe he'll be a magician when we show up at Oakmont. He's got all sorts of, you know, these equipment. He defers to the equipment too often for my liking. He takes agency. Getting into the mind of Bryson, as you put it, might be like, you know, unscrewing the back panel of a computer. You know, he used the word manufacturing. It's all up to the manufacturing what happens between now and Oakmont. You talked about how he just needs a ball that flies straighter, and you won't believe it. It's actually harder to control than you think at 190 mile per hour ball speeds or more. It's actually harder than you think. Well, that is the risk that comes with some of that great advantage of hitting it so fast and so far. I think he takes too much of his own agency and talent out of it and just says it's up to the manufacturing. He gave so much credit to his Pinehurst win last year to the equipment. And, you know, sometimes we've seen the equipment, whether it's the single length irons with some of the touch shots and wedge shots around the green. There's theories that, you know, the extra bulge in his irons might be causing more left spin like we saw in 17 on Saturday when he put it in the water. I think he just focuses way too much, over indexes way too much on the equipment. Honestly, and take some of his own credit, his own talent. He won the U.S. Amateur. He's won at every age, every level. And it takes talent. And I think, you know, it seems like he's overemphasizing what he needs to have happen to the equipment, to his golf ball between now and Oakmont, which is fast approaching in 3 weeks. I think it just takes too much credit and then also kind of puts too much pressure on him to get this timeline sped up for Oakmont.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for your insights today. Always fascinating.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Well, stay with us. We're going to talk more Scottie Scheffler with a man who was there calling it in person. Frank Nobilo will be stopping by with his takeaways from the 107th PGA Championship.
What an incredible start to the 2025 season in men's professional golf in April. It was Rory McIlroy who won the Masters, adding his name to the history books as he completed the career Grand Slam. Then on Sunday, world number one Scottie Scheffler was at it again. An even par round of 71 was good enough for a five-shot victory. He improves to 3-for-3 with the 54-hole lead at a major championship. And the action continues in just a few short weeks as Oakmont Country Club prepares to host the 125th U.S. Open.